Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. Today I'm joined by actually a very dear friend of mine, Paulette Crowley. Now, Paulette is a writer, she's a journalist, she's a mental health coach, she's a partner, she's a mother, and of course, she is sober. Welcome, Paulette.
Hi, thank you.
Where are you coming from? You live on Waiheke Island, is that right?
I do, yep, lovely Waiheke Island. It's a beautiful place. It's full of rich people and mansions, and I don't live in one of those, but I love being here.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Usual story with these sobriety chats. I know you've been over 10 years in recovery now, but if I could take you back, what can you tell us about, you know, the kind of potted version of your drinking story? When did you start and how did that journey go for you with alcohol?
Yeah, it's a pretty normal version of addiction or alcoholism, you know. Unfortunately, I grew up in a family of alcoholics. It was really normal to drink way too much all the time. It was just part of the culture of growing up in Australia in the 1970s. I suspect it was like that in New Zealand too, in the 80s. And so as soon as I could get my hands on it and drink the way I wanted to when I was about 14, I just drank way too much and liked to black out pretty much straight away. I was one of those disastrous people with alcohol. You know, people would say, you should not drink. And I'd be like, really? But I love it. And I live for it. You know, it didn't take me long to be in that mindset that my life just revolved around when I could drink again.
When you say you grew up with drinkers around you, because I did as well.
Yeah.
Did you have any sense of there was a darkness to it, or it was dysfunctional? Because in my world it was all just lovely, but it was dysfunctional and dark, but on the surface it was just normal, happy. Was yours like that, or was there more of an edge?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was a bit of both, you know, because we were kind of like, I don't know, a fairly, you know, progressive middle class family. Dad did really well in business, you know, we lived in a nice house and we were always, you know, had the nice clothes and holidays and things like that. So we were, you know, good people. But there was drunkenness all the time, you know. And I learned really quickly that there were kind of two states of being in my household, one when people were drunk and one when they weren't. And I soon learned that actually that I liked it better when they were drunk, because then I could get away with more. And they were happier, you know. And when they weren't drinking, that's when all the problems came, you know. That was when there was a lot of anger and stuff.
Right. So 14, you picked it up, and let's say you were enthusiastic from the get-go.
I loved it. It's like I could not believe that I hadn't been living with it for so long, you know. It's like,
Oh, your audio switched off for a moment. No. No, you've gone on mute.
Oh no.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry about that. Don't we love live technology things?
That's all good. I'm not going to edit this. Let's just keep rolling. So people would say to you, you shouldn't drink, but you did obviously. How long did you go for and how did it go over the years?
Yeah, well, you know, it was pretty disastrous pretty early for me, and it didn't take me long, probably till my sort of, I was about 18 or 19, where I'd had quite a few things go wrong. My mother got into recovery because she had a drinking problem too, and she was a great role model for me, because she taught me that what my problem was and that there was a solution. So I don't talk too much about what she did after that, but really that's where it got me to rehab when I was 19. And I did arrive kind of thinking, oh, thank God for that. I felt like I'd got off a roller coaster, you know. It was like, there is something gravely wrong with me. I know that. And now I know what it is and I know how to fix it. So, you'd think that the story ended there, but it didn't.
I was thinking, wait, 19, you're in rehab, you've been 10 years ish in recovery, and that makes you 29 now.
Yeah, it didn't work out. The maths didn't work out. Yeah, so anyway, I was really young, you know, and I stayed sober about a year, I think, and then went back to drinking because I thought I'd be okay and, you know, all the stories that you tell yourself that it'll be different this time and I know what I'm doing now and I'm older and I've got all these tools and I'm going to be okay. But it wasn't like that at all. It went back to problematic drinking. And it kind of marred everything I tried to do. You know, again, I was sort of replicating what my parents had done in that, you know, I got a good education and I got a good job and all those things, although I don't know how I did it half the time. I just kind of spackled together this life that looked okay on the outside. But yeah, you know, so it looked okay on the outside, but I was chopping and changing jobs all the time. I just couldn't settle. I burned through relationships and, you know, I just felt like everything was a bit of an F up on the inside. You know, I just drank too much all the time and I didn't know why. And I always thought that it would get better and it never did.
So this is interesting because you, having been in rehab and got some of the kind of knowledge or awareness of recovery and alcohol and this being a problem, then you went back to drinking for a number of years. Did you have that internal dialogue? Because I always say I was sort of ignorant in a way for so long to the alcohol being the problem until right at the end when I started getting 3 or 4 years of that internal, this is a problem, no, it's not. Did you have that the whole time because you'd had that early introduction into recovery, or did you manage to just push it aside and think there were other things wrong?
Well, I tried to push it aside and I was very good at, you know, telling myself a whole pile of stories like I wasn't an alcoholic and, you know, I just needed a break and all those things because I really wanted to drink. But deep inside, I knew I was an alcoholic and I used to tell myself I'll stop drinking later in life, you know, like when I'm 40, when I'm really old. And or when I have children or when this happens or when that happens. You know, I've heard since that there's a special kind of torture drinking when you know you're an alcoholic and when you know there's a solution and you've got a head full of recovery and a belly full of booze. It's like the worst kind of lie and betrayal that you can give to yourself. But I was prepared to live that way because I wanted to drink more than anything else.
And it's one of those things that's very hard to explain to people who haven't experienced it, but that slow eating away at your sense of self and your sense of strength and your sense of value because you know that you're doing something that, you know, is not serving you or whatever, and it's and there's no one else to blame. I mean, you know, you're the one doing it. It's so debilitating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I knew all of that and yet I still did it. So it was awful. But I kind of wouldn't change it because ultimately it did get me sober, just, you know, back on the path. But it was just a painful, painful thing to go through and put myself through.
Yeah, I feel the same way, actually. I wouldn't change it because of where I am now. But so what happened and when did you finally get to that point where that was enough and you put the drink down?
Yeah, well, I always had a thing about I didn't want to be a drunk mum. So I had my first child when I was, how old was I? 29. Unexpected pregnancy, completely out of the blue, and it stopped me in my tracks. Thank God I was someone who couldn't drink when I was pregnant. I was, you know, very sick, so couldn't drink, yay, and thought, this is it. This is like the divine intervention I was looking for. I'm now going to go forth and be a sober woman and, you know, have my shit together and just, you know, live the rest of my life. Another little sort of intervention that I thought would work. Didn't really, but I was just edging towards that sobriety more and more. So I got really serious about trying to get sober. At that point, after I had her, I relapsed again, but it was like, no, come on, get back on track. And I just, because I really, really, really wanted to stay sober. So I worked quite hard at that over the next kind of decade, maybe 14 years actually, of going in and out of recovery. You know, I'd have 18 months, 6 months, 10 months, lots and lots of months and 2 months and things like that, just in and out of recovery for all of that time, still just trying my hardest to do it. It was really, really difficult, but yeah. I finally managed to do it 14 years ago and sorry, 10 years ago and stay that way.
So in that long period, and it does sound hard, so my heart goes out to you, of on and off or in and out of recovery, was it quite dramatic, like all or nothing? Like when you were drinking, was it a dramatic return to alcohol or would it slowly
increase? Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it might sort of start off with a couple of drinks, but to be honest, actually, that only happened a couple of times. I was straight back into it every time, you know, two bottles of wine easily a night and, yeah, right back to where I started from. And it always gets worse, you know. The hangovers got worse. It was just horrible. But again, I kind of still loved it as much as I hated it. And I needed to change that balance. And to figure out how to stay stopped, because it was not the stopping so much, it was the staying stopped. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's not ignore the reality of the environment we live in, because we're doing this heroic work and it was heroic. 14 years of really trying. I mean, it's so I get it, like it's amazingly hard, but you're doing it in an environment that champions alcohol. It's left, right and centre. It's normalised. It's not just normalised, it's glamorised. It's cheap. You get judged for not drinking. Like the environment's stacked against us. So, you know, I want to also put that in the picture, because you're not just doing this in a bubble of joy. You're doing it in a world that says to us, drink.
Yeah, there is that kind of feeling, or at least there was for me, where I felt like an outlier of society, like I was just sitting on the edge. I wasn't allowed to participate the way that everyone else did, you know, if I wanted to stay sober. That, I mean, I disagree with that, what I told myself about that then, but, you know, that's how I felt at the time. And also I found out about myself that I've got ADHD. I found that out years down the track, and I look back at that time and realized that I was fighting against a brain that actively, you know, was working against me. So that was a big battle, and I wish I'd known about that earlier, because it could have been a lot easier for me, I think, if I'd known that.
What is it about the ADHD brain that made it work against you in this regard?
That, you know, you're constantly sort of out of whack in a biochemical sense. You know, you've got a lack of dopamine. Your brain doesn't produce dopamine the same way that other people's do. That's a very blanket way of saying it. But, you know, so you're constantly reaching to self-medicate, I guess, because you just don't feel good and you can't focus and your mood is going down all the time and you're impulsive, and yeah, that's, you know, in all the difficult things about ADHD really work against you when you're trying to stay sober, because, you know, all you want to do is feel better because you're constantly feeling like crap, you know. Something interesting that some people might not know is that we've got some New Zealand research, you probably know, Lotta, that one in two people with ADHD or neurodiversity end up having substance abuse issues and mental health issues as well. So it's a very real thing. It's not just it happens to some people. It happens to about half of people. That's New Zealand research.
I'll put the link into that research, and I know the Drug Foundation has been doing some great work on this. But you didn't find this out until after you'd been in recovery, you know, within this 10 years. At what point?
Yeah, it was only a few years ago, because my daughter was diagnosed with ADHD in about 2020 or 2019, I think it was. And as part of her diagnosis, you know, there was a big sort of interview process with the psychologist who went through with me our entire family history of mental health, which took some time because we're all bonkers. So I had this big long chat with her. And at the end of it, she said to me, Paulette, do you think that you should investigate this diagnosis yourself? And I thought, how rude. Like, I'm not the one with the problem here. I'm the mum. Like, my kid is the one jumping out the window and doing cartwheels instead of listening to you. It's not me. Yeah. But I knew, actually. It was kind of like, oh, God, I think she might be right. And then I kind of, it all fell into place. I started researching and madly reading and finding out things, and did go and do what she recommended and got a diagnosis, which came very easily. That's you. And then no wonder I drank. That's what I thought then, and that's what I sometimes think now. I mean, you know, alcoholism is complex, and there's a lot of stuff in there that's not easily explained, and there's no black and white answers, but I know it was a big reason for me.
When you were a youngster, were you jumping out the windows and doing cartwheels and things like that, similar to you?
Yes, I was that kid, you know, who would, I remember jumping off the roof, and I was always breaking my legs and, you know, swinging off the wardrobes and the clotheslines and things like that. But it wasn't just the physical stuff. It was, you know, I was the girl that couldn't stop talking in class and was separated from other people. And I'd do brilliantly at things I was interested in and fail dramatically if I wasn't, you know. It was a very kind of up and down thing. I had a lot of problems, you know, with my mood, regulating emotions and that kind of stuff. And it just explained so much about who I was and how I moved through the world, and why I found it incredibly difficult.
And that you'd adapted and tried to, you know, and you'd got right through to midlife where you'd kind of managed to make yourself fit, but you must have always felt, and especially when you're at school and you're being made to feel bad and wrong for talking and not understood. I mean, thank goodness we live in a world now where we have an understanding of neurodiversity and things like ADHD, because you probably also just had the sense of you being wrong, I'm wrong for so long. And now, was it like suddenly you were like, oh, I'm not wrong, I'm just this?
No. Yeah, that's just the way I am. Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a real grief in finding out something like knowing that you're neurodiverse, because you think things could have been so different if there'd been an early intervention in my life, you know, because we know research tells us that that makes a huge difference to the outcomes in someone's life, and that means for your health and all sorts of markers in your life. I wish that I'd known. I wish something could have been different. But, you know, it also just I felt like someone had given me the keys to the car, or, you know, handed me the operating manual. It's like, now you know what to do, you know, like, don't push yourself to do that because it's never going to work, or just be a bit easier on yourself with this, or lean into this, because that's a really big strength, you know. There's good parts and bad parts to it, but most of all, Claire, never drink again.
Oh, no. Well, that's right. And look, we all understand and get to know ourselves fully when we get sober, but to really have that kind of thing unlocked, which is a neurodiversity, is just so powerful. And the fact that you're using this now to help others, I want to get onto that in a minute, but can I just go back? So how many years sober were you when you found out about the ADHD?
I think it was probably 5 or 6 years sober.
So how did you do it without having that knowledge? What was it like for you in those 5 years, and especially the first year where you were still, you know, having the ups and downs with the brain, whatever? Like, how did you do it, Paulette? Because I know there'll be people watching this who are like, it's so hard.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, it was really hard. It was no picnic at all, you know. Some people have those recovery stories where, you know, their life, it's like sort of opening up the window and the light shines in and life's amazing. It was not like that for me. You know, sometimes I'd be like, it's honestly, it feels like it would be easier to drink sometimes because I just felt dreadful, you know. First of all, the physical stopping I found very hard because I was really dependent on alcohol at that point. I was drinking 2 or 3 bottles of wine a night. So I needed to sort of cut back on that quite gradually so I didn't have withdrawal symptoms. I was having some withdrawal symptoms, you know, like shaking and very sweaty and feeling nauseous and super sensitive and, you know, all that kind of stuff, itchy skin. It was horrible. So I had to cut back down. And so I was doing that with a doctor. And then I took some medicine to help me stay stopped, which is antabuse. I can't remember the other name for it. It's
naltrexone.
Not naltrexone. It's another one. It's called antabuse, and I can't remember the technical name for it, but I can give that to you later on if you like.
Oh, yeah,
but anyway, it's the one that means if you drink, you feel terribly sick and, you know, you can go to hospital sick kind of thing. So that was enough for me to not take a sip. And I needed to have that because I just didn't trust myself not to drink, and nobody else trusted me either. I had lost all faith in my ability to not drink. So I needed to have that insurance policy to stay stopped. And that really helped me in the beginning, because I knew that once I was taking that medication, I had 2 weeks where I couldn't drink without those terrible side effects. So it was, what it did for me was take the conversation out of my head of will I or won't I drink, because that was in my head, that conversation, from the moment I opened my eyes until the moment I went to bed. You know, I want to drink. No, you're not going to drink. That's, it's like a circus, and it just wouldn't shut up. And the antibiotics helped that voice to go away, because there was no option to be able to do that. Right. So for the first time, So that conversation was gone. That option was gone, and that freed up so much energy for me to actually just work really hard on rebuilding my life and my health and my recovery. And then I still didn't feel that great. You know, obviously I felt better than when I was drinking, but I was fragile, and my mood was all over the place. I was very tired. Probably for the first 6 months or so, I slept like every afternoon. I was just exhausted. I felt like I had a brain injury or something, you know. I wasn't able to function very well. But eventually, after about 6 months, I sort of went back to work and started functioning again. But I still had a lot of stuff going on with depression and anxiety, which had been lifelong, and it was still there after I stopped the drinking. So it was kind of a good thing, because I knew that it was independent of my drinking, the depression and anxiety. It wasn't because of the drinking, because at the time you don't know what's what when you're drinking, you know. If you're drinking to medicate your depression or whatever, the opposite. So I knew what I was, it gave me a level playing field to sort of see what was left in terms of, you know, my mental health stuff. So I just got as much help as I could through doctors and through just living a sober life, you know. And you know, there were still some really good times, feeling healthy and productive, but it was very up and down, and I kind of always felt like I was a bit too fragile to be consistent about things in life. But I thought, well, hey, you know, this is as good as it gets, and it's better than it was, so I'm grateful for that. But didn't realise that maybe it could be a bit better than that, and I'm really grateful for that now.
Oh, my God, you are a stone-cold legend. So how do you look after yourself now?
God, I have to look after myself really well. I'm one of those people that doesn't get away with much at all, like, you know. If I stay up too late, I fall apart the next day. You know, I have to kind of do things really quite rigorously and in a disciplined way. So I have to have really good sleep and protect that, so make sure I go to bed at the right time, blah blah. Exercise every day, and try and eat as well as I can. I still go for the food. I still turn to food as a bit of an addicty kind of thing, and I probably always will have that going on my whole life. I'm a lot more gentle with myself about that now. You know, like, sometimes it takes what it takes to get through a day, especially if you don't want to drink. And if I end up sort of having a duvet day with Netflix and ice cream, who cares, you know?
No. All right. I had a day the other day where it was honestly, I was just treated my body like an absolute garbage can. And I felt I had the same, like, guilt like I would when I would wake up hungover. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. We have to be kind to ourselves, and there's worse things. It's about the longer term overall picture. Occasional blips are okay.
Yeah. So it's just really good self-care, and that, you know, it's not just about the sleep and the exercise and the food. It's about making sure that I have a lot of social contact, because I'm very good at withdrawing and getting very intense about my work, or, you know, being introverted and not wanting to see people. That's where I kind of gravitate, especially in winter. And I need to go out and see people and do things. And I need sunshine and light, all that sort of stuff. I need to do some meditation and just everything I can to kind of just keep as balanced and even as possible. And most of the time it works most of the time.
Well, good on you. And let's just talk before we close about the work you do now supporting others. I know you write because I've read, and I'll put links to some of your pieces as well. You know, you do journalism and get that published and share your lived experience and kind of learnings, advice for others. But what other work do you do helping people?
Okay, so my lived experience led me to want to work in the addiction field, and I ended up qualifying as a registered mental health coach, and I help people to get sober. So I work in that addiction space with people who are trying to stop drinking and stay stopped. Yeah, so what I went through. So, yeah, I do that, and I love it. I really, really love it.
Oh, it's my favourite thing. I mean, obviously I do it through the Living Sober website, but to have that one-on-one contact is probably really beneficial for some people. They need more than an online community. I mean, a lot of our members, they do go to coaches, they go to counsellors, they go to meetings, you know, whatever it takes. We always say as many arrows in the quiver as you need to build, and especially early on. That's the thing, because over time the not drinking part becomes easier. But then it's just the actual living and dealing with the ups and downs, because life keeps on happening.
And I guess one of the things that helped me the most stay sober and still does to this day is being part of a community, because nobody gets it like another alcoholic. You know, you can have all the wonderful people in your life who love and adore you and support you, your friends, your family, but until they've experienced our addiction themselves, no one is going to get it, you know. So I need my alkies, I call them. I do.
What do you mean? Because I was thinking before when you were talking about that debate that you would have before you took the interviews, you know, that when I try and describe to people what a craving is like, because I think people don't get it. They think a craving is a physical pull, and it can be that, but it is the literal non-stop conversation in your head all day fighting. No one can see that or hear it, but it is all consuming. And I used to say the minute that I would make a decision to drink, even before I'd had the drink, that conversation would stop. And that is addiction.
Yeah, it is.
If you don't experience it, you don't know what it's like. It is all consuming, that mental game.
And it is, you know, a mental condition, a mental illness, if you like. I think the DSM calls it a mental illness. So until you've been through it, you don't really know. And that's why we need each other. And I truly believe that alcoholics help other alcoholics to stay sober.
Peer support, lived experience all the way.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for coming and chatting to me. I know I've said to you before that a lot of our members, it's coming up more and more, and obviously just discourse out there in the world, social media, about ADHD, which is fantastic. I think especially for women, where it can present sometimes differently than for men. But there's no greater thing than really getting to know yourself and how you work. That is it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it just explains so much about why I drank. And maybe I could just share this one thing as we go out. A psychiatrist explained ADHD to me as the one who diagnosed me, that it's like a layer cake. So the bottom layer is ADHD. Next layer is depression, next layer is anxiety, and then the next layer is substance abuse. And what she said was, if you take that bottom layer away, the other layers don't even exist. So if you treat the ADHD, all those other things might not develop. And that stuck with me. And to me, that combined, treating the ADHD combined with not drinking, has solved a lot of the problems. Simplistic, but you know, a nice little analogy.
Yeah, and also just speaks to the importance and the power of that piece of it. All right, beautiful. Thank you so much, Paulette. I've said already, but I'll put links to where people can find you and your writing and that research around ADHD and substance use that's been done in New Zealand. And just take good care of yourself.
Thank you. Appreciate. Will do. Thanks very much, Lotta.
Okay, cheers.
Bye.